the newsagents the day she had decided to die. The one who had seemed happy and relaxed. Carrie Anne. She hadn't noticed Nora because one child was wailing, and she was trying to pacify the distressed, red-cheeked boy by waving a plastic dinosaur in front of him. Me and Jake were like rabbits when we got there. Two little terrors. But worth it, you know. I just feel complete. I could show you some pictures. Then Carrie Anne looked up and saw Nora. I know you, don't I? Is it Nora? Yes. Hi, Nora. Hi, Carrie Anne. You remember my name? Oh, wow. I was in awe of you at school. You seemed to have it all. Did you ever make the Olympics? Yes, actually, kind of. One me did. But it wasn't what I wanted it to be. But then, what is, right? Carrie Anne seemed momentarily confused, and then her son threw the dinosaur onto the pavement and it landed next to one of the crumpled cans. Right. Nora picked up the dinosaur, a stegosaurus on close inspection, and handed it to Carrie Anne, who smiled her gratitude and headed into the house that should have belonged to Mr. Banerjee, just as the boy descended into a full tantrum. Bye, said Nora. Yeah, bye. And Nora wondered what the difference had been. What had forced Mr. Banerjee to go to the care home he'd been determined not to go to? She was the only difference between the two Mr. Banerjees, but what was that difference? What had she done? Set up an online shop? Picked up his prescription a few times? Never underestimate the big importance of small things, Mrs. Elm had said. You must always remember that. She stared at her own window. She thought of herself in her root life, hovering between life and death in her bedroom, equidistant, as it were. And, for the first time, Nora worried about herself as if she was actually someone else. Not just another version of her, but a different actual person. As though finally, through all the experiences of life she now had, she had become someone who pitied her former self. Not in self-pity, because she was a different self now. Then someone appeared at her own window. A woman who wasn't her, holding a cat that wasn't Voltaire. This was her hope, anyway, even as she began to feel faint and fuzzy again. She headed into town, walked down the high street. Yes, she was different now. She was stronger. She had untapped things inside her. Things she might never have known about if she'd never sung in an arena or fought off a polar bear or felt so much love and fear and courage. There was a commotion outside Boots. Two boys were being arrested by police officers as a nearby store detective spoke into a walkie-talkie. She recognized one of the boys and went up to him. Leo? A police officer motioned for her to back away. Who are you? Leo asked. Nora realized she couldn't say, your piano teacher. And she realized how mad it was given the fraught context to say what she was about to say. But still, she said it. Do you have music lessons? Leo looked down as the handcuffs were put on him. I ain't done no music lessons. His voice had lost its bravado. The police officer was frustrated now. Please, miss, leave this to us. He's a good kid, Nora told him. Please don't be too hard on him. Well, this good kid just stole 200 quid's worth from there, and has also just been found to be in possession of a concealed weapon. Weapon? A knife. No, there must be some mix-up. He's not that sort of kid. Hear that? The police officer said to his colleague. Lady here thinks our friend Leo Thompson isn't the kind of kid to get in trouble. The other police officer laughed. He's always in and out of bother, this one. Now please, the first police officer said, let us do our jobs here. Of course, said Nora. Of course. Do everything they say, Leo. He looked at her as if she'd been sent as a practical joke. A few years ago, his mum, Doreen, had come into string theory to buy her son a cheap keyboard. She'd been worried about his behaviour at school, and he'd expressed an interest in music, and so she wanted to get him piano lessons. Nora explained she had an electric piano and could play, but had no formal teacher training. Doreen had explained she didn't have much money, but they struck a deal, and Nora had enjoyed her Tuesday evenings teaching Leo the difference between major and minor seventh chords, and thought he was a great boy, eager to learn. Doreen had seen Leo was getting caught up in the wrong set, but when he got into music, he started doing well in other things too. And suddenly he wasn't getting into trouble with teachers anymore, and he'd play everything from Chopin through Scott Joplin to Frank Ocean and John Legend and Rex Orange County with the same care and commitment. Something Mrs. Elm had said on an early visit to the Midnight Library came to her. Every life contains many millions of decisions. Some big, some small. But every time one decision is taken over another, the outcomes differ. An irreversible variation occurs, which in turn leads to further variations. In this timeline right now, the one where she had studied a master's at Cambridge and married Ash and had a baby, she hadn't been in string theory on the day 4 years ago when Doreen and Leo came by. In this timeline, Doreen never found a music teacher who was cheap enough. And so Leo never persisted with music for long enough to realize he had a talent. He never sat there, side by side with Nora on a Tuesday evening, pursuing a passion that he extended at home producing his own tunes. Nora felt herself weaken. Not just tingles and fuzziness, but something stronger. A sense of plunging into nothingness, accompanied by a brief darkening of her vision. A feeling of another Nora right there in the wings, ready to pick up where this one left off. Her brain ready to fill in the gaps and have a perfectly legitimate reason to be on a day trip to Bedford, and to fill in every absence as if she was here the whole time. Worried she knew what it meant, she turned away from Leo and his friend as they were escorted away to the police car, the eyes of the whole of Bedford High Street upon them. And she started to quicken her pace towards the car park. This is a good life. This is a good life. This is a good life. A new way of seeing. She got closer to the station, passing the garish red and yellow zigzags of La Cantina like a Mexican migraine, with a waiter inside taking chairs off tables. And string theory, too, closed with a handwritten notice on the door. Alas, string theory is no longer able to trade in these premises. Due to an increase in rent, we simply couldn't afford to go on. Thanks to all our loyal customers. Don't think twice. It's all right. You can go your own way. God only knows what we'll be without you. It was the exact same note she had seen with Dylan. Judging by the date, written in small felt-tip letters from Neil's hand, it was from nearly 3 months ago. She felt sad, because string theory had meant a lot to people. Yet Nora hadn't been working at string theory when it got into trouble. Well, I suppose I did sell a lot of electric pianos, and some rather nice guitars too. Growing up, she and Joe had always joked about their hometown, the way teenagers do, and used to say that HMP Bedford was the inner prison, and the rest of the town was just the outer prison, and any chance you had to escape, you should take it. But the sun was out now, as she neared the station, and it seemed that she had been looking at the place wrong all these years. As she passed the statue of prison reformer John Howard in St. Paul's Square, with the trees all around and the river just behind, refracting light, she marveled at it as if she was seeing it for the first time. It's not what you look at that matters. It's what you see. Driving back to Cambridge, cocooned in her expensive Audi, smelling almost nauseatingly of vinyl and plastic and other synthetic materials, weaving through busy traffic, the cars sliding by like forgotten lives, she was deeply wishing she had been able to see Mrs. Elm, the real one, before she had died. It would have been good to have one last game of chess with her before she passed away. And she thought of poor Leo, sat in a small windowless cell at a Bedford police station, waiting for Doreen to come and collect him. This is the best life, she told herself, a little desperately now. This is the best life. I am staying here. This is the life for me. This is the best life. This is the best life. But she knew she didn't have long. The flowers have water. She pulled up at the house and ran inside, as Plato padded happily to greet her. Hello? She asked desperately. Ash! Molly! She needed to see them. She knew she didn't have long. She could feel the midnight library waiting for her. Outside, said Ash, chirpily from the back garden. And so Nora went through to find Molly on her tricycle again, unfazed by her previous accident, while Ash was tending to a flower bed. How was your trip? Molly climbed off her tricycle and ran over.
Mummy, I missed you. I'm really good at biking now.
Are you, darling? She hugged her daughter close and closed her eyes, and inhaled the scent of her hair and the dog and fabric conditioner and childhood, and she hoped the wonder of it would help keep her there. I love you, Molly. I want you to know that. Forever and ever. Do you understand?
Yes, Mummy. Of course.
And I love your daddy too. And everything will be okay because whatever happens, you will always have Daddy, and you will have Mummy too. It's just I might not be here in the exact same way. I'll be here, but... She realized Molly needed to know nothing else except one truth. I love you. Molly looked concerned.
You forgot Plato.
Well, obviously, I love Plato. How could I forget Plato? Plato knows I love him, don't you, Plato? Plato, I love you. Nora tried to compose herself. Whatever happens, they will be looked after. They will be loved. And they have each other, and they will be happy. Then Ash came over with his gardening gloves on. You okay, Nora? Seem a bit pale. Did anything happen?
Oh, I'll tell you about it later, when Molly's in bed.
Okay. Oh, there's a shop coming any time, so keep an ear out for the lorry.
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
And then Molly asked if she could get the watering can out, and Ash explained that as it had been raining a lot recently, it wasn't necessary, because the sky had been looking after the flowers. They'll be okay. They're looked after. The flowers have water. And the words echoed in Nora's mind. They'll be okay. They're looked after. And then Ash said something about going to the cinema tonight and how the babysitter was all arranged. And Nora had forgotten completely but just smiled and tried really hard to hold on, to stay there. But it was happening. It was happening. She knew it. from within every hidden chamber of her being, and there was absolutely nothing she could do to stop it. Nowhere to land.
No!
Unmistakably, it had happened. She was back in the Midnight Library. Mrs. Elm was at the computer. The lights wobbled and shook and flickered overhead in fast, arrhythmic blinks. Nora, stop. Calm down. Be a good girl. I need to sort this out. Dust fell in thin wisps from the ceiling, from cracks fissuring and spreading like spiderwebs woven at unnatural speed. There was the sound of sudden, active destruction which, in her sad fury, Nora found herself managing to ignore. You're not Mrs. Elm. Mrs. Elm is dead. Am I dead? We've been through this, but now you mention it, maybe you're about to be.
Why aren't I still there? Why aren't I there? I could sense it was happening, but I didn't want it to. You said that if I found a life I wanted to live in, that I really wanted to live in, then I'd stay there. You said I'd forget about this stupid place. You said I could find the life I wanted. That was the life I wanted. That was the life. Moments ago she had been in the garden with Ash and Nora and Plato. A garden humming with life and love. And now she was here.
Take me back.
You know it doesn't work like that.
Well, take me to the closest variation. Give me the closest possible thing to that life. Please, Mrs. Elm. It must be possible. There must be a life where I went for a coffee with Ash and where we had Molly and Plato, but I did something slightly different, so it was technically another life. Like I chose a different dog collar for Plato or where I did Pilates instead of yoga, or where I went to a different college at Cambridge, or if it has to be further back, where it wasn't coffee on the date, but tea. That life. Take me to the life where I did that. Come on, please, help me out. I'd like to try one of those lives, please.
The computer started to smoke. The screen went black. The whole monitor fell to pieces. You don't understand, said Mrs. Elm, defeated, as she collapsed back into the office chair.
But that's what happens, isn't it? I pick a regret, something I wish I had done differently. And then you find the book, I open the book, and I live the book. That's how this library works, right?
It's not that simple.
Why? Is there a transference problem? You know, like what happened before?
Mrs. Elm looked at her sadly.
It's more than that.
There was always a strong possibility that your old life would end.
I told you that, didn't I?
You wanted to die and maybe you would.
Yes, but you said I just needed somewhere to go
to.
Somewhere to land. That's what you said. Another life. Those exact words. And all I needed to do was think hard enough and choose the right life and...
I know. I know.
But it didn't work out like that.
The ceiling was falling down now, in pieces, as if the plaster was no more stable than the icing of a wedding cake. Nora noticed something even more distressing. A spark flew from one of the lights and landed on a book, which consequently ignited into a glowing burst of fire. Pretty soon the fire was spreading along the entire shelf, the books burning as rapidly as if they were doused in petrol. A whole stream of hot, raging, roaring amber. Then another spark arced towards a different shelf, and that too set alight. At about the same time, a large chunk of dusty ceiling landed by Nora's feet.
Under the table, ordered Mrs. Elm. Now!
Nora hunched down and followed Mrs. Elm, who was now on all fours under the table, where she sat on her knees and was forced, like Mrs. Elm, to keep her head down.
Why can't you stop this?
It's a chain reaction now. Those sparks aren't random. The books are going to be destroyed, and then just as inevitably, the whole place is going to collapse.
Why?
I don't understand. I was there. I had found the life for me. The only life for me, the best one in here.
But that's the problem,
said Mrs. Elm, nervously looking out from beneath the wooden legs of the table as more shelves caught on fire and as debris fell all around them.
It still wasn't enough.
Look.
At what?
At your watch.
Any moment now.
So Nora looked, and at first saw nothing untoward. But then it was happening. The watch was suddenly acting like a watch. The display was starting to move. 0 hours. 0 minutes. 0 seconds. 0 hours. 0 minutes. 1 second. 0 hours. 0 minutes. 2 seconds.
What's happening?
Nora asked, realizing that whatever it was probably wasn't good.
Time. That's what's happening.
How are we going to leave this place? 0 hours. 0 minutes. 9 seconds. 0 hours. 0 minutes. 10 seconds.
We're not, said Mrs. Elm.
There's no we. I can't leave the library. When the library disappears, so do I. But there is a chance you can get out, though you don't have long, no more than a minute. Nora had just lost one Mrs. Elm. She didn't want to lose this one too. Mrs. Elm could see her distress.
Listen, I am part of the library.
But this whole library is part of you. Do you understand? You don't exist because of the library. The library exists because of you. Remember what Hugo said? He told you that this is the simplest way your brain translates the strange and multifarious reality of the universe. So this is just your brain translating something. Something significant and dangerous.
I gathered that.
But one thing is clear. You didn't want that life.
It was the perfect life.
Did you feel that? All the time?
Yes, I mean, I wanted to. I mean, I loved Molly. I might have loved Ash. But I suppose, maybe, it wasn't my life. I hadn't made it by myself. I had walked into this other version of me. I was carbon copied into the perfect life. But it wasn't me. 0 hours. 0 minutes. 15 seconds.
I don't want to die, said Nora, her voice suddenly raised but also fragile. She was shaking from her very core.
I don't want to die.
Mrs. Elm looked at her with wide eyes, eyes shining with the small flame of an idea.
You need to get out of here.
I can't. The library goes on for bloody ever. The moment I walked in it, the entrance disappeared.
Then you have to find it again.
How? There are no doors.
Who needs a door when you have a book?
The books are all on fire.
There's one that won't be.
That's the one you need to find.
The Book of Regrets.
Mrs. Elm almost laughed.
No, that is the last book you need. That will be ash by now.
That will have been the first book to burn. You need to go that way. She pointed to her left, to chaos and fire and falling plaster.
It's the 11th aisle that way, third shelf from the bottom.
The whole place is going to fall down. 0 hours, 0 minutes, 21 seconds. 0 hours, 0 minutes, 22 seconds. 0 hours, 0 minutes, 23 seconds.
Don't you get it, Nora?
Get what? It all makes sense. You came back here this time not because you wanted to die, but because you want to live. This library isn't falling down because it wants to kill you. It's falling down because it is giving you a chance to return. Something decisive has finally happened. You have decided you want to be alive. Now go on. Live while you still have the chance. But what about you? What's going to happen to you? Don't worry about me, she said. I promise you, I won't feel a thing. And then she said what the real Mrs. Elm had said when she had hugged Nora back at the school library on the day her dad had died. Things will get better, Nora. It's going to be all right. Mrs. Elm placed a hand above the desk and hastily rummaged for something. A second later, she was handing Nora an orange plastic fountain pen, the kind Nora had owned at school, the one she had noticed ages ago. You'll need this. Why? This one isn't already written. You have to start this. Nora took the pen. Bye, Mrs. Elm. A second later, a massive chunk of ceiling slammed into the table. A thick cloud of plaster dust clouded them, choking them. 0 hours, 0 minutes, 34 seconds. 0 hours, 0 minutes, 35 seconds. Go! Coughed Mrs. Elm. Live! Don't you dare give up, Nora Seed. Nora walked through the haze of dust and smoke in the direction Mrs. Elm had pointed towards as the ceiling continued to fall. It was hard to breathe and to see, but she had just about managed to keep count of the aisles. Sparks from the lights fell onto her head. The dust stuck in her throat, nearly causing her to vomit. But even in the powdery fog, she could see that most of the books were now ablaze. In fact, none of the shelves of books seemed intact, and the heat felt like a force. Some of the earlier shelves and books to set on fire were now nothing but ash. Just as she reached the 11th aisle, she was hit hard by a chunk of falling debris that floored her. Pressed under rock, she felt the pen slip out of her hand and slide away from her. Her first attempt to free herself was unsuccessful. This is it. I am going to die, whether I want to or not. I am going to die. The library was a wasteland. 0 hours, 0 minutes, 41 seconds. 0 hours, 0 minutes, 42 seconds. It was all over. She was certain of it once more. She was going to die here, as all her possible lives were ravished around her. But then she saw it, amid a brief clearing in the clouds. There, on the 11th aisle that way, third shelf from the bottom. A gap in the fire that was consuming every other book on the shelf. I don't want to die. She had to try harder. She had to want the life she always thought she didn't. Because just as the library was a part of her, so too were all the other lives. She might not have felt everything she had felt in those lives, but she had the capability. She might have missed those particular opportunities that led her to become an Olympic swimmer, or a traveller, or a vineyard owner, or a rock star, or a planet-saving glaciologist, or a Cambridge graduate, or a mother, or the million other things. But she was still in some way all those people. They were all her. She could have been all those amazing things. And that wasn't depressing, as she had once thought. Not at all. It was inspiring. Because now she saw the kind of things she could do when she put herself to work. And that, actually, the life she had been living had its own logic to it. Her brother was alive. Izzy was alive. And she had helped a young boy stay out of trouble. What sometimes feels like a trap is actually just a trick of the mind. She didn't need a vineyard or a Californian sunset to be happy. She didn't even need a large house or the perfect family. She just needed potential. And she was nothing if not potential. She wondered why she had never seen it before. She heard Mrs. Elm's voice from under the table somewhere far behind her, cutting through the noise.
"Don't give up! Don't you dare give up, Nora Seed!"
She didn't want to die. And she didn't want to live any other life than the one that was hers. The one that could be a messy struggle, but it was her messy struggle. A beautiful, messy struggle. 0 hours, 0 minutes, 52 seconds. 0 hours, 0 minutes, 53 seconds. As she writhed and pushed and resisted the weight on top of her, and as the seconds ticked on, she managed, with a great exertion that burned and stifled her lungs, to get back onto her feet. She scrabbled around on the ground and found the fountain pen thickly coated in dust, then ran through the particles of smoke to reach the 11th aisle. And there it was. The only book not burning. Still there, perfectly green. Flinching at the heat, and with a careful index finger, she hooked the top of the spine and pulled the book from the shelf. She then did what she always did. She opened the book and tried to find the first page. But the only difficulty was that there was no first page. There were no words in the entire book. It was completely blank. Like the other books, this was the book of her future. But unlike the others, in this one, that future was unwritten. So, this was it. This was her life. Her root life. And it was a blank page. Nora stood there a moment, with her old school pen in hand. It was now nearly 1 minute after midnight. The other books on the shelf had become charcoal, and the hanging light bulb flickered through the dust, vaguely illuminating the fractured ceiling. A large piece of ceiling around the light, roughly the shape of France, was looking ready to fall and crush her. Nora took the lid off the pen and pressed the book open against the charred stack of bookshelves. The ceiling groaned. There wasn't long. She started to write. Nora wanted to live. Once she'd finished the inscription, she waited a moment. Frustratingly, nothing happened, and she remembered what Mrs. Elm had once said. Want is an interesting word. It means lack. So she crossed that out and tried again. Nora decided to live. Nothing. She tried again. Nora was ready to live. Still nothing, even when she underlined the word live. Everywhere now there was breakage and ruination. The ceiling was falling, raising everything, smothering each of the bookshelves into piles of dust. She gaped over and saw the figure of Mrs. Elm, out from under the desk where she'd been sheltering Nora, standing there, without any fear at all, and then disappearing completely as the roof caved in almost everywhere, smothering remnants of fire and shelf stacks and all else. Nora, choking, couldn't see anything at all now. But this part of the library was holding out. And she was still there. Any second now, everything would be gone. She knew it. So she stopped trying to think about what to write. And in sheer exasperation, just put down the first thing that came to her. The thing that she felt inside her like a defiant, silent roar that could overpower any external destruction. The one truth she had. A truth she was now proud of and pleased with.
a truth she had not only come to terms with, but welcomed openly, with every fiery molecule of her being. A truth that she scribbled hastily but firmly, pressing deep into the paper with the nib, in capital letters, in the first person present tense. A truth that was the beginning and seed of everything possible. A former curse and a present blessing. Three simple words containing the power and potential of a multiverse. I am alive. And with that, the ground shook like fury, and every last remnant of the Midnight Library dissolved into dust. Awakening. At 1:27 after midnight, Nora Seed marked her emergence back into life by vomiting all over her duvet. Alive, but hardly. Choking, exhausted, dehydrated, struggling, trembling, heavy, delirious. Pain in her chest, even more pain in her head. This was the worst life could feel. And yet it was life. And life was precisely what she wanted. It was hard, near impossible to pull herself off the bed, but she knew she had to get vertical. She managed it somehow and grabbed her phone, but it seemed too heavy and slippy to keep a grasp of, and it fell onto the floor beyond view.
Help,
she croaked, staggering out of the room. Her hallway seemed to be tilting like it was a ship in a storm, but she reached the door without passing out, then dragged the chain lock off the latch and managed, after great effort, to open it.
Please, help me.
She barely realized it was still raining as she stepped outside in her vomit-stained pajamas, passing the step where Ash had stood a little over a day before to announce the news of her dead cat. There was no one around. No one that she could see. So she staggered towards Mr. Banerjee's house in a series of dizzy stumbles and lurches, eventually managing to ring the doorbell. A sudden square of light sprung out from the front window. The door opened. He wasn't wearing his glasses, and was confused, maybe because of the state of her and the time of night.
I'm so very sorry, Mr. Banerjee. I've done something very stupid. You'd better call an ambulance.
Oh, my Lord. What on earth has happened?
Please.
Yes, I'll call one right away. 0 hours, 3 minutes, 48 seconds. And that is when she allowed herself to collapse, forwards and with considerable velocity, right onto Mr. Banerjee's doormat. The sky grows dark, the black over blue, yet the stars still dare to shine for you. The other side of despair. Life begins, Sartre once wrote, on the other side of despair. It wasn't raining anymore. She was inside and sitting in a hospital bed. She had been put on a ward and had eaten and was feeling a lot better. The medical staff were pleased following her physical examination. The tender abdomen was to be expected, apparently. She tried to impress the doctor by telling her a fact Ash had told her about a stomach lining renewing itself every few days. Then a nurse came and sat on her bed with a clipboard and went through reams of questions relating to her state of mind. Nora decided to keep her experience of the Midnight Library to herself because she imagined it wouldn't go down too well on a psychiatric evaluation form. It was safe to surmise the little-known realities of the multiverse
probably weren't yet incorporated within the care plans of the National Health Service. The questions and answers continued for what felt like an hour. They covered medication, her mother's death, vaults, losing her job, money worries, the diagnosis of situational depression. "Have you ever tried anything like this before?" the nurse asked. "Not in this life." "And how do you feel right now?"
"I don't know.
A bit strange. But I don't want to die anymore." And the nurse scribbled on the form. Through the window, after the nurse had gone, she watched the trees' gentle movements in the afternoon breeze, and distant rush-hour traffic shunt slowly along Bedford Ring Road. It was nothing but trees and traffic and mediocre architecture, but it was also everything. It was life. A little later, she deleted her suicidal social media posts, and, in a moment of sincere sentimentality, she wrote something else instead. She titled it, "A Thing I Have Learnt," written by a nobody who has been everybody. A Thing I Have Learnt, written by a nobody who has been everybody. It is easy to mourn the lives we aren't living. Easy to wish we'd developed other talents, said yes to different offers. Easy to wish we'd worked harder, loved better, handled our finances more astutely, been more popular, stayed in the band, gone to Australia and said yes to the coffee, or done more bloody yoga. It takes no effort to miss the friends we didn't make, and the work we didn't do, and the people we didn't marry, and the children we didn't have. It is not difficult to see yourself through the lens of other people, and to wish you were all the different kaleidoscopic versions of you they wanted you to be. It is easy to regret, and keep regretting ad infinitum until our time runs out. But it is not the lives we regret not living that are the real problem. It is the regret itself. It is the regret that makes us shrivel and wither and feel like our own and other people's worst enemy. We can't tell if any of those other versions would have been better or worse. Those lives are happening, it is true, but you are happening as well. And that is the happening we have to focus on. Of course, we can't visit every place, or meet every person, or do every job. Yet most of what we'd feel in any life is still available. We don't have to play every game to know what winning feels like. We don't have to hear every piece of music in the world to understand music. We don't have to have tried every variety of grape from every vineyard to know the pleasure of wine. Love and laughter and fear and pain are universal currencies. We just have to close our eyes and savor the taste of the drink in front of us and listen to the song as it plays. We are as completely and utterly alive as we are in any other life, and have access to the same emotional spectrum. We only need to be one person. We only need to feel one existence. We don't have to do everything in order to be everything, because we are already infinite. While we are alive, we always contain a future of multifarious possibility. So let's be kind to the people in our own existence. Let's occasionally look up from the spot in which we are, because wherever we happen to be standing, the sky above goes on forever. Yesterday I knew I had no future, and that it was impossible for me to accept my life as it is now. And yet today, that same messy life seems full of hope, potential. The impossible
I suppose, happens via living. Will my life be miraculously free from pain, despair, grief, heartbreak, hardship, loneliness, depression? No. But do I want to live? Yes. Yes. 1,000 times. Yes. Living versus understanding. A few minutes later, her brother came to see her. He'd heard the voicemail she'd sent him and had responded by text at 7 minutes after midnight. You okay, sis? Then, when the hospital contacted him, he'd caught the first train from London. He'd bought the latest issue of National Geographic for her while waiting at St. Pancras Station. You used to love it, he told her, as he placed the magazine beside the hospital bed. I still do. It was good to see him. His thick eyebrows and reluctant smile still intact. He walked in a little awkward, head cowed, hair longer than it had been in the last 2 lives in which she had seen him. I'm sorry I've been incommunicado recently, he said. It wasn't about what Ravi said it was about. I don't even think about the labyrinths anymore. I was just in a weird place. After Mum died, I was seeing this guy and we had a very messy breakup and I just didn't want to have to talk to you or recently to anyone about it. I just wanted to drink. And I was drinking too much. It was a real problem. But I've started getting help for it. I haven't had a drink for weeks. I go to the gym and everything now. I've started a cross-training class. Oh, Joe. Poor you. I'm sorry about the breakup. And everything else. You're all I've got, sis, he said, his voice cracking a little. I know I haven't valued you. I know I wasn't always the best growing up. But I had my own shit going on. Having to be a certain way because of Dad. Hiding my sexuality. I know it wasn't easy for you, but it wasn't easy for me either. You were good at everything. School, swimming, music. I couldn't compete. Plus, Dad was Dad, and I had to be this fake vision of whatever he thought a man was. He sighed. It's weird. We probably both remember it in different ways. But don't leave me, okay? Leaving the band was one thing, but don't leave existence. I couldn't cope with that. I won't if you won't, she said. Trust me, I'm not going anywhere. She thought of the grief that had floored her when she had heard about Joe's death by overdose in Sao Paulo. And she asked him to hug her. And he obliged, delicately. And she felt the living warmth of him. Thanks for trying to jump in the river for me, she said. What? I always thought you didn't. But you tried. They pulled you back. Thank you. He suddenly knew what she was talking about. And maybe more than a little confused about how she knew this, when she had been swimming away from him. Ah, sis. I love you. We were young fools. Joe nipped out for an hour. Picked up the keys from her landlord, collected his sister's clothes and phone. She saw that Izzy had texted. Sorry I didn't get back last night, this morning. I wanted a proper discussion. Thesis, antithesis, synthesis, the whole works. How are you? I miss you. Oh, and guess what? I'm thinking of coming back to the UK in June, for good. Miss you, my friend. Also have a ton of humpback pics coming your way. Kiss, kiss, kiss. Nora made a slight noise of involuntary joy at the back of her throat.
she texted back. It was interesting, she mused to herself, how life sometimes simply gave you a whole new perspective by waiting around long enough for you to see it. She went on the Facebook page of the International Polar Research Institute. There was a photograph of the woman she had shared a cabin with, Ingrid, standing with the field leader, Peter, using a thin measuring drill to gauge the thickness of sea ice, and a link to an article headlined, IPRI Research Confirms Last Decade Warmest on Record for Arctic Region. She shared the link and posted a comment, "Keep up the great work," and decided that when she earned some money, she would donate. It was agreed that Nora could go home. Her brother ordered an Uber. As they were pulling out of the car park, Nora saw Ash driving into the hospital. He must have been on a late shift. He had a different car in this life. He didn't see her, despite her smile, and she hoped he was happy. She hoped he only had an easy shift of gallbladders ahead of him. Maybe she would go along and watch him in the Bedford Half Marathon on Sunday. Maybe she would ask him out for a coffee. Maybe. In the back of the car, her brother told her he was looking for some freelance session work. "I'm thinking of becoming a sound engineer," he said. Vaguely, anyway. Nora was happy to hear this. "Well, I think you should do it. I think you'd like it. I don't know why, I've just got a feeling." "Okay. I mean, it might not be as glamorous as being an international rock star, but it might be safer. Maybe even happier." That was a tough sell, and Joe wasn't entirely buying it. But he smiled and nodded to himself. "Actually, there's a studio in Hammersmith, and they're looking for sound engineers. It's only 5 minutes from me, I could walk it." "Hammersmith? Yes, that's the one." "What do you mean?" "I mean, I just think it sounds good. Hammersmith, sound engineer. It sounds like you'd be happy." He laughed at her. "Okay, Nora. Okay. And that gym I was telling you about, it's right next door to the place." "Ah, cool. Any nice guys there?" "Actually, yes, there is one. He's called Ewan. He's a doctor. He goes to cross-training." "Ewan, yes." "Who?" "You should ask him out." Joe laughed, thinking Nora was just being playful. "I'm not even 100% sure he's gay." "He is. He's gay. He is 100% gay and 100% into you. Dr. Ewan Langford, ask him out. You have to trust me. It will be the best thing you ever do." Her brother laughed as the car pulled up at 33A Bancroft Avenue. He paid, on account of Nora still having no money and no wallet. Mr. Banerjee sat at his window reading. Out on the street, Nora saw her brother staring in astonishment down at his phone. "What's up, Joe?" He could hardly speak. "Langford." "Sorry?" "Dr. Ewan Langford. I didn't even know his surname was Langford, but that's him." Nora shrugged. "Sibling intuition. Add him. Follow him. DM him. Whatever you have to do. Well, no unsolicited nude pics, but he's the one, I'm telling you. He's the one." "But how did you know it was him?" She took her brother by the arm and knew there was no explanation she could possibly give. "Listen to me, Joe." She remembered the anti-philosophy of Mrs. Elm in the Midnight Library. "You don't have to understand life. You just have to live it." As her brother headed towards the door of 33A Bancroft Avenue, Nora looked around at all the terraced houses and all the lampposts and trees under the sky, and she felt her lungs inflate at the wonder of being there, witnessing it all as if for the first time. Maybe in one of those houses was another slider. Someone on their third or 17th or final version of themselves. She would look out for them. She looked at number 31.
Through his window, Mr. Banerjee's face slowly lit up as he saw Nora safe and sound. He smiled and mouthed a thank you, as if simply her act of living was something he should be grateful for. Tomorrow she would find some money and go to the garden center and buy him a plant for his flower bed. Foxgloves, maybe. She was sure he liked foxgloves. No, she called back, blowing him a friendly kiss. Thank you, Mr. Banerjee. Thank you for everything. And he smiled broader, and his eyes were full of kindness and concern. And Nora remembered what it was to care and be cared for. She followed her brother inside her flat to start tidying up, catching a glimpse of the clusters of irises in Mr. Banerjee's garden as she went. Flowers she hadn't appreciated before, but which now mesmerized her with the most exquisite purple she had ever seen. As though the flowers weren't just colors but part of a language. Notes in a glorious floral melody, as powerful as Chopin, silently communicating the breathtaking majesty of life itself. The volcano. It is quite a revelation to discover that the place you wanted to escape to is the exact same place you escaped from. That the prison wasn't the place, but the perspective. And the most peculiar discovery Nora made was that, of all the extremely divergent variations of herself she had experienced, the most radical sense of change happened within the exact same life, the one she began and ended with. The biggest and most profound shift happened not by becoming richer or more successful, or more famous, or by being amid the glaciers and polar bears of Svalbard. It happened by waking up in the exact same bed, in the same grotty damp apartment, with its dilapidated sofa and yucca plant, and tiny potted cacti, and bookshelves and untried yoga manuals. There was the same electric piano and books. There was the same sad absence of a feline, and lack of a job. There was still the same unknowability about her life ahead. And yet, everything was different. And it was different because she no longer felt she was there simply to serve the dreams of other people. She no longer felt like she had to find soul fulfillment as some imaginary perfect daughter, or sister, or partner, or wife, or mother, or employee, or anything other than a human being, orbiting her own purpose, and answerable to herself. And it was different, because she was alive, when she had so nearly been dead. And because that had been her choice, a choice to live. Because she had touched the vastness of life, and within that vastness, she had seen the possibility, not only of what she could do, but also feel. There were other scales and other tunes. There was more to her than a flat line of mild to moderate depression, spiced up with occasional flourishes of despair. And that gave her hope. And even the sheer sentimental gratitude of being able to be here, knowing she had the potential to enjoy watching radiant skies and mediocre Ryan Bailey comedies and be happy listening to music and conversation and the beat of her own heart. And it was different because, above all other things, that heavy and painful book of regrets had been successfully burnt to dust. Hi, Nora. It's me, Doreen. Nora was excited to hear from her, as she had been in the middle of neatly writing a notice advertising piano lessons. Oh, Doreen, can I just apologize about missing the lesson the other day? Water under the bridge. Well, I'm not going to go into all the reasons, Nora continued breathlessly.
But I will just say that I will never be in that situation again. I promise, in future, should you want to continue with Leo's piano lessons, I will be where I am meant to be. I won't let you down. Now, I totally understand if you don't want me to be Leo's piano teacher anymore, but I want you to know that Leo is an exceptional talent. He has a feel for the piano. He could end up making a career of it. He could end up at the Royal College of Music. So I would just like to say, if he doesn't continue his lessons with me, I want you to know that I feel he should continue them somewhere. That's all. There was a long pause. Nothing but the fuzzy static of phone breath. Then, Nora, love, it's okay, I don't need a monologue. The truth is, we were in town yesterday, the two of us. I was just buying him some face wash, and he said, I'm still going to do piano, right? Right there in Boots. Should we just kick off where we left off next week? Seriously? That's amazing. Yes, next week then. And the moment Nora came off the phone, she sat at the piano and played a tune that had never been played before. She liked what she was playing and vowed to remember it and put some words to it. Maybe she could turn it into a proper song and put it out there online. Maybe she would write more songs. Or maybe she would save up and apply for a master's. Or maybe she would do both. Who knew? And as she played, she glanced over and saw her magazine, the one Joe had bought her, open at a picture of the Krakatoa volcano in Indonesia. The paradox of volcanoes were that they were symbols of destruction, but also life. Once the lava slows and cools, it solidifies, and then breaks down over time to become soil. Rich, fertile soil. She wasn't a black hole, she decided. She was a volcano. And like a volcano, she couldn't run away from herself. She'd have to stay there and tend to that wasteland. She could plant a forest inside herself. How it ends. Mrs. Elm looked a lot older than she had done at the Midnight Library. Her formerly grey hair was now white and thin. Her face tired and lined as a map, hands spotted with age. But she was as adept at chess as she had been years ago in the Hazeldene School Library. Oakleaf Care Home had its own chessboard, but it had needed a dust down. No one plays here, she told Nora. I'm so pleased you came to see me. It was such a surprise. Well, I can come every day if you want, Mrs. Elm. Louise. Please call me Louise. And don't you have work to do? Nora smiled, even though it had only been 24 hours since she had asked Neil to put up her poster in string theory. She was already inundated with people wanting lessons. I teach piano lessons, and I help out at the homeless shelter every other Tuesday. But I will always have an hour. And to be honest, I have no one to play chess with either. A tired smile spread across Mrs. Elm's face. Well, that would be lovely. She stared out of the little window in her room, and Nora followed her gaze. There was a human and a dog Nora recognized. It was Dylan, walking Sally the bull mastiff, the nervous one with the cigarette burns who'd taken a shine to her. She wondered, vaguely, if her landlord would allow her to get a dog. He'd allowed a cat, after all, but she'd have to wait until she caught up with the rent. It can be lonely, Mrs. Elm said, being here, just sitting. I felt like the game was up, like a lonely king on a board. You see, I don't know how you remember me, but outside of school, I wasn't always... She hesitated. I've let people down. I haven't always been easy. I've done things I regret. I was a bad wife. Not always a good mother, either. People have given up a little on me, and I don't entirely blame them. Well, you were kind to me, Mrs. Louise. When I had a hard time at school, you always knew what to say. Mrs. Elm steadied her breath. Thank you, Nora. And you're not alone on the board now. A pawn has come and joined you. You were never a pawn. She made her move, a bishop sweeping into a strong position. A slight smile tugged at the corners of her mouth. You're going to win this, Nora observed. Mrs. Elm's eyes sparkled with sudden life. Well, that's the beauty, isn't it? You just never know how it ends. And Nora smiled as she stared at all the pieces she still had left in play, thinking about her next move. This is Kerry Mulligan. We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of The Midnight Library by Matt Haig. This program was produced and directed by Lisa Hollinshead. Text copyright 2020 by Matt Haig. Production copyright 2020, Canongate Books. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.